we need a new open for it, because now we have 75 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
You're right. Do you have any ideas for what you would want to say? Do we have a catchphrase?
Do we have a catchphrase? I don't know. Catchphrase? Don't quit.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. Once again, I am Terry Foy, joined by Quint Kesnick. And Quint, we thought we were going to get away from week five without significant changes to the top 20. That will not be the case, because among other upset action this weekend, on Sunday afternoon, the Brown Bears handed the number 8 Virginia Cavaliers a 14-13 loss in Providence, Rhode Island, and there is a lot to unpack from this one, but I want to start with goalie Phil Goss, who finished with 16 saves, and he made 4 consecutive stops in the fourth quarter as Brown built a 2-goal lead late. They let in one to make it a 1-goal game finish, and Virginia had a shot coming out of a timeout in order to tie the game, but ultimately I felt like it was Goss's performance in the fourth quarter that secured the win for the Bears.
What happens on spring break stays on spring break.
But it also stays on your season-long resume, and the NCAA tournament selection committee looks at it just the same as at any other point in the season.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. I met with the chairman of that committee this week at Towson, and we talked about the process. We talked about the criteria. So it doesn't matter if the win happened in February, March, or April. It doesn't matter if your team had an assortment of injuries and or sickness. This is a nice win for Brown over Virginia. And you think about, suddenly Virginia drops, got to be out of the top 10, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there wasn't a whole lot of margin in terms of how many spots they could have fallen and stayed in the top 10.
No, I know. And you know, coming into the Sunday morning, I was looking at my top 20. As you said, it was a sedate Saturday. Not really any game-changing results that would shift the order of power. And then Sunday is completely the opposite. You've got really 4 marquee games that all are going to impact the top 20 and all are going to require some shuffling. So I think it's pretty cool.
So a little bit more on this Brown upset. I mentioned one of the storylines coming in, Lars Tiffany, Sean Kerwin, Kip Turner returning to their old stomping grounds. But I think this is the biggest win of the Mike Daly era for the Bears. You know, they were coming off losses to Brown and Stony Brook. It looked like perhaps another middling season was in store for Brown. And certainly one game doesn't tell the story of a season. Think about the fact that Colgate beat Syracuse in Matt Kerwick's first ever game as a head coach, and the Raiders are really struggling this year. But that being said, I'm disproportionately familiar with Brown's talent by virtue of my exposure to these guys when they were going through the recruiting cycle. And two in particular, sophomore middies Reed Machete and Colby Gendron, have stood out as guys that really performed at the Committed Academy. And if they're just monstrous. Gendron is 6'7", Machete is 6'4", 6'5". They're both well over 220 pounds. And I've just been thinking, if these guys develop into Ivy League level productive midfielders, from a matchup standpoint, they just represent something unlike anything else you see in college lacrosse. And when you talk about Ivy League recruiting, which is kind of the subtext of the season that the Ivy League has gotten off to in the first month, the Brown is not that far away from that top 4 pack that has, you know, kind of consistently been in the top 20 so far this season.
Well, they've owned Princeton in recent history. You know, Princeton has not appeared in the Ivy League tournament. Brown has, and we've gotten an up-close look at Phil Goss. And I tell you, every time I've seen him in person, it's 2 years in a row up at Columbia live, stood next to the goal as he's warming up, stood behind the goal during the game. I just couldn't be more impressed. I mean, I don't know if there's a more talented goalie in the country. This guy, you know, when he's done, when he graduates from Brown, he may want to hire a lawyer and go back and sue the school for lack of defensive support. but man, that kid is a player. And
I mean, there was a reason he was the U.S. 19 goalie.
Yeah.
You know, his talent has been identified for a really long time, but you're right. I mean, it has appeared to have been a combination of the style that they wanted to play and the organization at that end of the field that, you know, has led to results that didn't probably meet the hopes of Mike Daly and his staff since arriving in Providence. And I feel like, again, you know, this is the type of game where you can certainly overreact to it, but there were enough things that you saw that were like, Brown is better than they have performed so far this year. And if they can raise their floor to this level, then of course they're going to be really dangerous in the Ivy League. One sequence that I want to point out.
And to tag on that, my one issue with Virginia, again, is defense. You know, you give up 14 to Brown, no Cade Sostad, still working in some new shorties, not named John Fox. The close defense is inexperienced for the most part, other than Kyle Kaloji. And they're just not on the same page. You got two freshmen starting down low. You got a bunch of new faces at the short stick position. It's going to get a little dicey, I think, in ACC play this year. And Virginia, I don't think, can be looked at as the favorite right now in the ACC. I think Syracuse is a strong one. And after that, I think the pack's pretty wide open.
I would agree, but at the same time, you shouldn't sell short the fact that in a game where 100 shots were taken, in which Brown faced off well, giving up 14 isn't necessarily a losing recipe, right? And realize
no, but in combination with Phil Goss's 16 saves, you know, I think the new standard is 12. I mean, if you hold a team to 12 or less, you expect to win.
For sure, for sure. So that being said, that is a very good point, because the sequence that took this game from tied at 10 to Brown leading 12-10 is another in a couple of instances this weekend that put a shine of focus on officiating. Brown's 11th goal came after Alex Rode, I can't recall whether he made a save or corralled a ground ball in the crease, but he was pulling the stick back in order to make his clearing pass, and Jack Niffen did the very normal swipe at his cross. I'm pretty confident that he made contact with it. You saw Rode's cradle take a hitch that it doesn't usually take, and the ball ended up in the back of the net. It was not declared interference. The goal was allowed, and then the 12th goal came on a Brown fast break in which Michael Thomas ended up with a diving effort. A flag was thrown. Looked to me like he landed in the inner crease. It was deemed a push, but the goal stood and the flag was waved off. I felt like that was pretty textbook. It was a push, but the goal should not have been allowed because he ended up in the goal mouth area, and as a result, the goal should have been waved off and Brown should have been on a 30-second extra man. So a couple of touchy sequences that, you know, ultimately led to the margin of victory.
It's a difficult game to ref. I mean, we saw another goal, no goal call in the Hopkins-Syracuse game, which you'll talk about. You actually posted a nice picture, Zach Babbo, with an incredible photo of what I thought was a goal in real time and then in our replay sequence. And just brings up the question, you know, do we need replay help in NCAA tournament games that are televised? Does that need to be part of the standardized process?
Well, we'll see. Well, in NCAA tournament games, it is available from the quarterfinals on. And my viewpoint is I do not want to see replay in college lacrosse. I don't think replay has helped sports broadly. I do think that a fourth official is necessary, a fourth official on the field. And I do believe that, number one, I understand the expense components of it. And number two, I understand the component of the mechanics will change and it'll take 3 to 5 years in order for that to work out. But when you look at the number of players on the field, the amount of space covered per official, lacrosse is far and away the most onerous on the three officials on the field. And when you compare it to baseball, when you compare it to soccer, when you compare it to football, I mean, especially when you compare it to football, oh my goodness, you know, there's seven or nine officials on the field for 22 players. You know, there's 20 players on the field. The field is bigger than a football field. And there are three officials. Like, it's just, to your point, a very hard game to ref.
Yeah. You know, one thing we haven't talked about, Terry, is scheduling. And I just find it a little odd that Virginia, their spring break starts like today. They go up to Brown. I mean, if you're Lars Tiffany, you had to know that Brown would be foaming at the bit to play against their former coach, the guy who recruited them and then left them. That's a tough spot emotionally for Virginia. Do you agree with that?
I 100% agree with it. I don't. Well, I agree with it with one exception, which is that absolutely Lars Tiffany knew the lion's den that he was walking into. He's just the type of coach who wants to take on these challenges, right?
Yeah,
and so,
yeah.
But the one thing he didn't account for was the good karma coming away from the Lacrosse for Life effort that was spearheaded by Brown lacrosse players. And if you believe in karma,
yeah,
you have to look at those $2.1 million dollars donated to Boston Children's and wonder whether or not that might have been worth a goal in this game.
Well, had I known that, I would have
put
Brown
$2.1 million on the Bears.
Yeah. No, that initiative, those guys are so impressive, what they were able to achieve, and good to see all that money going to the different causes and everybody getting involved. It's just really, and what's been kind of a tough week with the COVID-19 and the fear and the paranoia about the season, and you know we're not sure where we're going. You know, this uncertainty. That was, I felt, one of the best stories of the year.
And I want to shout out those guys specifically, not just for the effort led to raise the funds, but also because of what they knew was going to be a cool byproduct, which was seeing all these shaved heads all across college lacrosse. And so I was at the Duke Loyola game. You were at Hopkins Syracuse. I'll get to that in a second. But it was really cool to see in the post game all three of the, well, JT Giles Harris typically keeps his hair short, so I don't know for sure that he shaved his head, but definitely Joy Manown and Turner Upgrim shaved their head, I believe, as part of the effort this week. And then for Loyola, Ryan McNulty did as well. And those guys said it was going to be really cool to see all the guys with shaved heads all over college lacrosse. And I didn't really understand or think about it until I saw it, and I was like, they're right. That is a really cool thing.
I love it.
Let's move on to another big Sunday result. We already kind of mentioned it. The Drexel Dragons handing Villanova a 15-12 defeat shortly on the heels of the Wildcats' win over Penn on Friday night. Both games, including both teams also facing off against, or St. Joe's being included in that mix, Drexel having played them on Friday night, the Hawks playing the Quakers on Sunday afternoon, a part of the Philly Four Classic. And this one, you got to give credit to Reed Bowering, who led the way with 6 goals and an assist, and Ross Blumenthal made 14 saves as the Dragons advanced to 3-3 on the season. Like I mentioned, Nova had advanced to 4-2 on Friday night with their second consecutive top 10 win. They beat the Quakers 12-10, and Keegan Kahn, Connor Kirst, and Patrick Daly combined for 10 goals. Dylan Gergar had 6 for Penn. And I just want to quickly shout out Kirst for one of the best plays I've seen so far this season, which I believe the game was tied 10-10 late in the fourth quarter, and his end line ride that forced a turnover by Patrick Birkinshaw, who otherwise I thought played okay, finished with 13 saves, and then another shot clock reset later led to the eventual game-winning goal. And Kirst is just one of those players who makes plays all over the field.
After Friday night's win, I had Villanova potentially in the top 10, but I just, with this loss, they give it all away. You know, I don't know. It's kind of a reversion to their inconsistent self.
100%. 100%.
That we hadn't seen this year, really. I thought they did a much better job of dealing with victories and playing on a more even keel. But you got to give Ross Blumenthal credit, the camper. He's one of my goalie camp guys. And if you saw him the first time he rolled into goalie camp wearing black football pants with thigh pads and knee pads, there's no way you'd ever think Ross Blumenthal would be leaving the Dragons to a win like this. So it's great to see that. I don't know what to do with Villanova. I don't know what to do with Penn either now. You know, I know Sam Handley's out, but they're just losing so many games. It's hard to keep them elevated. I like this idea in Philadelphia. I would encourage other, whether it's Central New York, whether it's Baltimore, the Long Island region, Boston. You know, I think that these type of weekend showcases just they're a positive for local media in the community. I think people can attach to those events, and I would encourage other jurisdictions to do them. I mean, meanwhile, in Baltimore this weekend, we had like 6 games played within a 20-mile-hour driving radius that all kicked off, faced off within an hour of one another. And then there's nothing on Sunday. Like, and it's a beautiful 56-degree day on Sunday. So, I don't know. I think, again, these coaches could care less about attendance at their games. All they care about is attendance at their camps. But I wish that someone were focused on the fan.
I agree with you to a degree. I actually think that these Friday Sunday events are really smart, but I actually think it's smarter when you bring in 3 out of market teams or 2 out of market teams, and then you kind of rotate through. I think that your local games are best reserved for Tuesday nights and Wednesday nights in April, but that's just me, and I know no one agrees with me, so whatever. We're gonna move on. You mentioned big lacrosse action in Baltimore. Syracuse Orange came to Homewood Field and handed Johns Hopkins a 15-9 defeat. The number one Orange have now ended up such that the Blue Jays are 1-4 for the first time in program history. To me, the story of this game was the short stick midfield, the decision to put a short stick midfielder on Stephen Rafus. He ended up with 7 assists, unbelievable day facilitating. Chase Scanlon had 5-1, Jamie Trimboli had 4-1, Tucker Dordovic had 3 goals, Brennan Curry had 2 goals, and it was a game very similar, I think, to the game that we're going to talk about next, which is, you know, there were some opportunities for Hopkins to get on the board early. Drake Porter closed the door. He made 4 great stops in order to keep Hopkins scoreless. He ended up with 16 saves on the day. And as a result, the Blue Jays were never really in it. And, you know, it was similar to what Duke did to Loyola. But I do think that, some of the decisions that Hopkins made defensively and some of the ways in which Syracuse took advantage of it offensively, and you could tell by the post-game comments that, you know, they took it personally, and they also thought that the strategy was a little bit flawed, and certainly it manifested itself that way.
Well, I don't, looking at it, you look at Hopkins' defensive personnel, you look at Syracuse's offensive personnel, how many of those matchups can Hopkins win, regardless of where they put the poles? And, you know, they determined that they wanted the ball in Rafus's stick, and they were happy to keep it out of the stick of Curry, Dordovic, and Trimboli. But give Syracuse credit, because the willingness to share the ball, the willingness to make multiple passes, I hadn't seen that on tape. Quite honestly, if you watch their Army and Hobart games, it's a lot of isolation, unassisted goals. It's a lot of outside bombing. So this was a new wrinkle for Syracuse recently. I thought they passed the ball really well. I liked their spacing. I liked everything about it offensively. Saw some wrinkles defensively against a single invert that needs some work. And again, you mentioned Drake Porter. Picture this, Terry. What if you traded goalies in this game? What would the first quarter have looked like in that scenario?
It's an interesting question. It's hard for me to answer.
Because Hopkins gave up some of the softest goals I've ever seen. I mean, those were soft goals. And I thought Porter made 3 stops early of his 4 that easily could have been goals.
So along those lines, and maybe we can just transition and talk about these games concurrently, because Duke beat Loyola 13-10. They got out to an 8-0 lead. Loyola got an extra man goal with 1:47 to go in the first quarter. Half, so right before halftime, Kevin Lindley got him on the board, made it 8-1. Loyola did a really nice job bouncing back in the third quarter and cut the game to 10-7, and then Duke responded with 3 straight goals, and that was basically the ball game. Both goalies got off to good starts. I think both goalies, it was 0-0 midway through the first quarter, and both goalies had 4 saves. Upgren, who ended up having his best game of the season, and Sam Schaefer, who was ended up being pulled at halftime. So I hear where your point is, but I also watched a game in which both goalies made saves early, and ultimately it didn't hold up in terms of the way that the result unfolded subsequently. So I don't know. It couldn't hurt, but I don't think it would have helped that much. I don't think it would have been the reason that Hopkins would have won.
I like Porter a lot. I think he's got a really calm demeanor. You know, he was terrific he was a player of the match against Army. I thought he regressed against Hobart, but he's very good against Johns Hopkins. And the defense was good. I thought Brett Kennedy played much better for Cuse as well defensively. He struggled a bit against Hobart. He was a little out of control. He played a A-plus game the other day. And Cuse, you know, Cuse won most of the individual matchups across the board. It's a good team, and I think they'll take a step forward off this win. Their first road game of the year, they got a tough schedule coming up. They're on the road quite a bit, and when they're home, they're outside. So it's kind of a different dynamic for the Orange this year.
The Orange are 5-0. They head to Rutgers and Duke in subsequent weeks, and then host Notre Dame at the end of the month, like you said, at Cicero North Syracuse High School. As I mentioned, Duke got kind of, I don't want to say they righted the ship, right? Because they were coming off of an overtime win versus Richmond and a one-sided win against Furman on Sunday. But this has been a game, you know, it's always the game at the end of Loyola spring break, at the beginning of Duke spring break. So, you know, you kind of get two teams in different positions. Last year, Pat Spencer was really hampered by injury, and the Greyhounds weren't very competitive in a loss in Durham.
We covered that game. I was at that game. It was over before it started.
Yeah. I was really interested in this game and got an opportunity to talk to both coaching staffs beforehand. And my overall thought process was, this is always a formative game. And I recall, I mean, this is, you know, for me, I will always remember the 2006 game very definitively because I was there and it was, you know, basically the last game before the party that ended the season. The following year, Loyola won in San Diego, and that was a big result that kind of, I think, kickstarted a little bit the Charlie Toomey era. And then the 2012 game, which I wasn't at because it was the same day as Faceoff Classic, but I recall hearing from Dave Cottle through you afterward that his comment was, this Loyola team athletically can win a national championship, and of course that ended up proving true. And so my overall thesis for this series is that it flies under the radar as being super important and super revealing for both teams. And that's before you even get into some of the postseason, you know, histrionics, including the Charlie Toomey timeout in overtime that would have ended the game in a first-round Loyola loss in Durham, and then certainly Loyola returned the favor in 2016 on reach of their Final Four season. But ultimately, my attitude heading into this 2020 matchup was that both these teams were in positions where this game was more formative than it had been in prior years, because both teams are less who they are going to be in a month or 6 weeks than they had been in prior years because of just the way that the personnel machinations are coming together. You know, for Duke, it's still at the defensive end where replacing Cade Van Raphorst has been a challenge. For Loyola, it's at the offensive end where replacing Pat Spencer has been a challenge. And that's why Duke's defense came in rated number 48 in defensive efficiency, and Loyola's offense came in rated 51 in offensive efficiency. And that was the end of the field that decided this game, as the Greyhounds couldn't score for more than 28 minutes. But there were a couple of things that you could take away on both sides that I think were healthy steps forward. You mentioned that Duke's first midfield had been benched in recent games, and they played really well in this one. Kai Montgomery had 3-1. Kevin Quigley had 2 assists. Garrett Ledman had 2 goals. When those guys are clicking they create matchup problems because they are so fast and quick and strong. And I thought you saw that with Loyola, you know, fluctuating between a zone and man-to-man. They didn't really change their matchups too much, and not only that, honestly, I felt like from a playmaking standpoint, Loyola actually got a good day out of their shorties and long stick, not in transition offense, but in terms of ground ball defense in their own end. And I also thought that Loyola got a good day out of Bailey Savio. So they're, and certainly they scored 5 of 7 extra man goals, so they can be pleased with that and hopefully build on top of that. But if you're Loyola, your ability to beat a team that's as athletic as Duke is defensively in the 6-on-6, honestly, it just doesn't exist right now. So you got to figure out something.
And that doesn't bode well against Army, because Army's been playing a tight man-to-man defense, slow to go. They're not really sliding. They're making you win their matchups. They had success against Syracuse using that tactic, and I expect them to try to suffocate Loyola. My issues with Loyola, you know, look at every team they've beaten on their schedule. It's unfortunate, but they've all just tail spun out of their games against Loyola, and none of them have done anything. You beat Hopkins, you think it's a big deal. You beat Towson, you beat Rutgers. Last year, those wins meant something. This year, they don't win very much, and I think some Loyola fans have put a lot of stock into those early wins and overrated their team. It's a good Loyola team. It's a young team. It's going to get better, as you said. They're getting healthy in a couple areas defensively, but the shooting remains, I think, their biggest Achilles heel right now.
Make no mistake about it. Loyola does not have a path to an at-large bid. They have to win the Patriot. I think they have to win the Patriot.
I completely agree with you. I mean, it's an unfortunate schedule dynamic. The same group of teams you played last year rated you high at a conference, and all of a sudden this year, you know, Rutgers and Johns Hopkins look to be bottom of the pack in the Big Ten. Really, you know, not getting the same strength from Towson last year, who hosted a first round game. So that's just unfortunate, and it's amazing how much it differs year to year.
Another team whose record is probably casting them farther below the radar than they deserve to be is Albany, who lost 14-13 in College Park against Maryland, but put on an incredible show down the stretch in order to make this game a one-goal game. They are 2-3. Tohoka Nanacoke has just blossomed. He has 5 goals in his last 3 games, and he had 4 goals in the game prior to that. He's got 27 points in the season. They lost 17-12 to UMass at UMass on Tuesday, but at the same time, like, for his, just to be blunt, for as bad as Albany was last year, they're not that bad this year, and they're going to make noise. I mean, this is kind of obvious, right? They're going to make noise in the America East. And, you know, it's April 4th when they play Syracuse. We just talked about between now and then, Rutgers, Duke, and Notre Dame for the Orange. But that's going to be a huge game for Albany because it's the first time Syracuse comes to KC Stadium. And in between now and then, Albany's got games against UMass Lowell, Binghamton, and Hartford. They should be 5-3 welcoming the Orange to town. And that would be a game that right now, I think I'm picking the Great Danes.
You're crazy.
Okay.
That's not happening. Albany went to a zone, okay? They got run by UMass's midfielders. And we talked about UMass has got really, really good dodging midfielders. You saw it against Yale. There were six times in that Yale game that UMass middies diced Yale shorties and or offensive middies. Well, UMass did the same thing against Albany. So what was Scott Moore's reaction this weekend? Zone. They went zone against Maryland, and it changed the tenor of that game entirely. That game was played so off script. You know, you're thinking about Albany and Maryland this year, high scoring, 18-17. Well, it was lower possessions, lower scoring. Maryland was lucky that they won so many faceoffs, and it'll be interesting now to see if Scott Maher and Albany become a zone team this year. It's going to hurt their transition, but they've been struggling so much in man-to-man that maybe that's the answer.
One more game I want to talk about, Denver 14, Notre Dame 11. It was the Pioneers' first top 10 win of the season. Ethan Walker, 4-2, really balanced scoring effort along the rest of the team, particularly from the midfield. Jack Hanna, 2-2, Ted Sullivan, 2 goals, Sam Dwinell, 2 goals, Alex Simmons, 1-2. Jack Thompson made 12 saves. Notre Dame, another team that made a change in goal. Liam Entenmann started. He made 7 stops and let up 12 goals. They went to Matt Schmidt with about, I don't know, it was in the third quarter. I think he played the last like 23, 24 minutes, something like that. Wheaton Jacoboys had a good day with 4 goals. If you're Notre Dame, you started 2-0 with wins over Cleveland State and Richmond and now lost in successive weeks to Maryland and Denver.
You can watch Notre Dame on Sunday, March 15th. That's a week from yesterday, basically, 4 o'clock, ESPNU, 4 o'clock, Michigan, Notre Dame. It's a big game for Notre Dame, you know, because I thought there were some bright spots. I'm just not seeing enough ball handling behind the goal from the attack. It's really a midfield generated offense. And then off ball issues defensively kind of defined why they gave up so many goals to Denver. Denver's sneaky athletic at the midfield and their poles. They got some horses like Hanna and Sullivan. These guys are monsters. So I think this is going to be a turning point for Denver. They play Ohio State coming up this week on Columbus on the road. It's not easy, but then after that, when they start their league schedule, this Notre Dame game could be the turning point of their season.
You mentioned Michigan. I got eyes on Yale's 17-11 win over the Wolverines in the Pacific Coast Shootout on Saturday night. That game started at 7 p.m. local time, so it was pretty late for most of the East Coasters.
I caught the first 10 minutes.
the Bulldogs got out to a 6-1 lead.
That's when I turned it off.
Yeah, had a record day. Matt Gaudette had a great day. But ultimately, the Michigan kept throwing haymakers, and you know, even though Yale was able to separate late, Michigan cut this to a goal. I think they tied it maybe at 9-9, 10-10, somewhere in that range. So they continued to play hard, and another team whose record suggests they're not very good, but they are going to be able to play competitively and put some scares into a number of different folks.
Couple bullet points here. Michigan can score. They've had some defensive issues this year. Their slide packages, Matt Gaudette's really smart. He puts himself on that high slot area where if his guy's hot, you know, then he fades to space, or he understands the recovery where if his guy's the two slide, he makes it really hard for that off weak side defender to find him. And he had a nice day shooting the ball. T.D. Erland setting the faceoff record, I believe, in this game. He basically won every faceoff, and Yale still gives up 11 goals, which is, you know, is that concerning? A little. It is. When you win so many faceoffs, you don't expect to give up 11 goals. But again, 11 is not bad by any kind of new standard. And then Handsome Dan was a little under the weather last week with a minor food allergy, but I want to report that he's back to 100% strength.
Good news note. Another important news note. Jack Starr started this game. I think it was his first start of the season, as Brady Wilson had started the first game, the first three games, excuse me, for the Bulldogs. A couple other news items I want to point to. The Boston University Bucknell game was canceled due to illness among the Terrier squad. I don't mind reporting on this podcast. It is not coronavirus. It is, despite the fact that there were some concerns within the Boston Health Department, and there was, at least as of Saturday, hope that this game could be rescheduled for early this week, potentially Tuesday, which would then, you know, make a Tuesday-Saturday scenario for both teams, as Bucknell has Loyola next weekend and Boston University has Holy Cross.
You know, I mentioned it in my column, Terry, so I think I'm going to talk about it right now, but there's a lot of fear and paranoia and I don't want to say misinformation, but we got to deal with this from a patient standpoint and from a smart standpoint. You know, whether you're a high school player or a college player, clean your locker, you know, wash your hands a lot, keep your stuff around the facility as clean as you can, okay? And the same goes with your dorm room and or your apartment. When you guys hop on the bus, okay, be careful. When you go to airports, when you go to hotels, those are areas where you can encounter germs, bugs. I mean, it's a life that I live, and I am always 100% paranoid about stuff like that. I don't touch remote controls in hotels. Okay, I'm a little wacky when it comes to that. I always travel in long pants and a long shirt, try not to touch anything in the plane. This is how I've been living my life for the last 20 years. So I just ask everybody to travel smart, to travel stealthy, to take responsibility for their behavior when they're out at a club or a bar, and just be conscious of the people you're associating yourself with and the situations you're putting yourself in. Because if one player from, let's say, a team gets sick, that impacts that whole team, which could impact the league, which could impact the entire country of Division I landscape. You know, so right now everything's good, but who knows where this is going to go? We just got to be vigilant and stay as clean and safe as we can.
That's a good place to end, but I don't want to end without mentioning that Michael Scowers scored his 300th point as a Princeton Tiger in Princeton's 16-11 win over the Rutgers.
That's a lot.
Scarlet Knights. It is a lot. Congratulations.
He may
on
get the 400.
The Maestral Cup.
You think he's not? He can't get to 400, but he could get to 370.
Yes.
He only had 5 points the other day.
He did.
That's like a down day. I mean, I look at him like, oh, he only had 5. Wow. What happened?
I mean,
how crazy is that? What kind of standard has Michael Scowers set? And Princeton looked good. You know, Slusher scored a nice wing goal in that game. Verdaro's playing well. I mentioned their polls.
Jake Stevens is awesome. Connor McCarthy is such a matchup problem. Chris Brown, he's just a big, he can play midfield attack. He's like a 50-50 assisted goal guy. They're good. I'm surprised, but I mean, you know, it's not even, so I'm actually not surprised because it's not that Princeton's good. I think Princeton has been good for a while, but they're good in a way that they're capable of not playing well. That's what they have been over the last like 3 to 4 years. And now they haven't played poorly. That's the difference.
They have to win enough games to get into the Ivy League tournament. And they haven't been able to do that. They have not been able to beat Brown. Okay. They play Penn on March 14th. Penn is at Princeton on the 14th. Okay, can they win a meaningful game against a high echelon Ivy League team? They haven't done it with Mike Scowers. I think the only time he made the tournament was when he was a freshman, I believe.
He's got 47 points so far this season, and he's basically averaging almost 10 points a game. And if you look at their schedule, they're probably going to have 10-ish games left. I don't think he's going to keep at that pace, but yeah, if he keeps at a 7-point pace, very realistic, then yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying it's something to watch. The other thing I wanted to bring up, Quint, is Johns Hopkins right now is 1-4, as we discussed. It is possible for them to win their next 5 games and be 6-4 going into their end of season 3-game stretch, Penn State, Ohio State, Maryland. That would change the complexion of this season and this team. But for right now, there's some very unhappy Johns Hopkins fans. And it's been discussed in different channels that Dave Petromala is in the final year of his contract as the Blue Jays head coach. And I wonder what the media coverage is going to be this week, particularly in the Baltimore local media, around that particular topic.
Well, the good news is that they play Mount St. Mary's on Tuesday, 6 o'clock.
So Short news
on
cycle.
ESPN3. I've got that game with Booker Corrigan. The best thing for a player, like a midweek game, is really good because it takes you out of the long, the waiting and the 5 practice week cycle. And so you're kind of back at it. So that's a positive for this team, especially coming off a loss. The scary thing is that Mount's pretty good. And Mount hung with them last year for about a half. It's a game into the third quarter. It was still very much a game. So, you know, Mount's got to win over Towson. Mount's got to win over Utah. The Mount's legit. So that'll be interesting Tuesday night. Alongside us on ESPNU, you get to see Jacksonville at Duke. Tuesday night, 6 o'clock, Jacksonville at Duke. Chris Cotter and Miles Jones in Durham for that one.
Well, make sure you hit up Inside Lacrosse's scoreboard for all of the links to those streams. And if, as always, you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review. As always, we appreciate you listening, and we will be back next week with more Quick Restart Podcast. You're not going to tell me you love me?
Don't quit. Wash your hands. We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.